Coming up right now, The Space Show. Welcome to The Space Show, presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I'm Andrew Rennie. On this evening's The Space Show, Nothing So Hidden, Episode 3 of 3, The Voyage of Apollo 16. And, well, we better get underway pretty quickly.
We'll have a lovely afternoon, kiss the world goodbye, and away we fly. Destination moon, travel fast as light, till we're lost from sight. The Earth is like a toy balloon.
Welcome to the final of our three-part series, Nothing So Hidden, The Story of Apollo 16. 50 years ago, John Young, Charlie Duke, and Ken Mattingly were being debriefed after their 10-day voyage to the Descartes region of the Moon. Young and Duke had descended to Descartes in the lunar module Orion, whilst Mattingly had continued orbiting the Moon in the command and service module Casper. Before the space age, there was an energetic debate in the scientific world as to whether the craters on the Moon were caused by asteroid impacts or by volcanic activity. One of the reasons the Descartes region was chosen as an Apollo landing site was because Descartes was thought to be volcanic. Young and Duke were tasked with finding volcanic rocks. They found none. They were almost all impact breccias. Breccias are rocks that are composed of fragments of other, older rocks. The breccias are formed by the shock of bombardment by meteorites. The shock causes heat and pressure that fuses small rock fragments from earlier impacts into new rocks. The Apollo 15 crew had found a special type of rock called anorthosite, which they dubbed the Genesis rock. Anorthosite is a type of intrusive igneous rock composed predominantly of calcium-rich plagioclase feldspar. All anorthosites found on Earth consist of coarse crystals, but some samples of rock taken from the Moon are finely crystalline. It is visible as light-coloured parts of the lunar highlands. At 4 billion years, these are the Moon's oldest rocks. The Apollo 16 astronauts did find two significant anorthosite rocks, one with a mass of 1.8 kilograms and which was dated at 4.36 billion years old. Well, recent unmanned missions orbiting the Moon have been able to map the rock types around the Moon. It turns out that the Apollo 16 crew narrowly missed out on finding lots of anorthosite. And this feature has someone who knows about that.
Good morning from Hawaii. My name is Kiara Tarori Wong. I'm a third-year graduate student now at the University of Hawaii, and I'm here today to talk about a spectrometer we are building that can be adapted to provide 1 meter resolution of polar landing sites in the thermal infrared. All right, so in order to go forward to the Moon with Artemis, I want us to first take a look at the past with a cautionary tale and understand what could have been had we only known. When the Apollo 16 lunar module landed, it landed in between North Ray Crater and South Ray Crater. The crew ventured up to North Ray Crater to take some samples, and then they traversed south, about halfway to South Ray Crater. Now, what no one could have possibly known at that time was that just 6 kilometers away from the landing site and maybe about 2-3 kilometers from their furthest traverse south was that there was a field of pure anorthosite boulders, just like what Apollo 15 had brought back from Spur Crater, also known as the Genesis Rock, or 15415. But instead of just one sample of the moon's primordial crust, imagine just for a moment an entire field of anorthosite boulders, an entire field of Genesis rocks. So Apollo 16 was only 6 kilometers away, which to me is frustratingly close. What if we had known that there was pure anorthosite before Apollo 16 landed near South Ray Crater? And what if we had known that there was pure anorthosite before we landed on the moon for the first time? What would have changed? What would we have known? With Apollo, there was very little prior information on the composition of the surface to know of this anorthosite field. But today is different. Today, we have a lot more compositional information. So for Artemis, I asked this question. What if we knew the composition of every single boulder at a landing site at the lunar south pole? Well, for one, we could optimize mission planning. We have a lot more composition of information about the moon today from instruments like Diviner, M-cubed, multiband imager, and soon Trailblazer. But even those can't tell us about the composition on a human scale, which is incredibly important for when you want to put astronauts on the moon. However, it's not that far outside of our reach of sensing capabilities. Currently at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, we are building a CubeSat for NASA's Earth Science and Technology Office called HiTi, or the Hyperspectral Thermal Imager. And that will launch in 2021 from the International Space Station. HiTi, without any optical redesign, the instrument on board could be used to map rock compositions and craters as fine as 3 meters on the lunar surface, which would already be at a finer scale than previous missions. Now, the thermal infrared is a unique spectral range that can be used to characterize the bulk mineralogy of silicate minerals. HiTi, the instrument on board HiTi, has a spectral range of 7 to 11.5 microns with a spectral resolution of 13 wave numbers, where signatures of major moon minerals can be unambiguously identified at high spectral and spatial resolutions. HiTi is currently designed to fly in low Earth orbit at 400 kilometers, and it will have a spatial resolution on the ground of 60 meters per pixel. If you were to fly the same exact optics in lunar orbit at 50 kilometers, say, we could achieve a spatial resolution of 6 meters on the ground, 6 meters per pixel. If we were to fly the instrument in a lunar orbit of 20 kilometers without any redesign, we could achieve a spatial resolution of 3 meters per pixel. Now that's even better in terms of human scale, coming in at just a little more than the height of Jack Schmidt. But this is about the limitation of the current optical system. And if we want to do better, a modest redesign would be necessary. To get something on the order of 1 meter per pixel, a larger telescope would definitely be necessary, along with a camera detector that has a faster readout, which would require the modest technical development. But 1 meter is achievable under these circumstances, and most definitely on a human scale, and what we like to call sub-Jack Schmidt resolution. We know that the optical design can give us the spatial resolution we want, but the moon is not the same as the Earth. So can it perform under lunar polar illumination conditions? And we can investigate this by estimating the signal-to-noise ratio of the HiTi instrument performing at the moon. 273 Kelvin is about as cold a rock can be at this constant illumination, at the constant illumination conditions at the pole. And much higher temperatures are more likely. HiTi at various rock temperatures meets or exceeds the performance requirements necessary. With HiTi's current capabilities, 3 and 6 meter resolution maps of the lunar surface can be made. And with some optical redesign, 1 meter resolution maps of the lunar surface can also be made. This would allow for individual boulder compositions to be classified on a human scale and be incredibly useful for Artemis mission planning. Regardless, we will definitely get amazing science out of investigating the lunar south pole. But with HiTi, fewer discoveries would fall through the cracks. Thank you very much.
And here we are in 2022 with the Artemis plan to return humans to the moon well underway. Now, it's well to remember that the Apollo missions were conducted in the science areas and in the some of the technical support areas by people who were fresh out of college, very, very young people. And now we have the youngsters like Shara Farrara Wong, we've just heard from. She's a graduate student at the University of Hawaii, picking up the mantle to get humans back to the moon. Giant steps are what you take, walking. Where, you might wonder, can you see these wonderful Apollo machines of half a century ago? Well, if you want to see the Apollo 16 lunar module, then you'll need to go to the moon. The descent stage sits proudly on Descartes, surrounded by the Apollo lunar surface experiments, the American flag, and the lunar roving vehicle number 2. You will remember that Orion's ascent module was supposed to be deorbited and crashed onto the moon to create a seismic signal for the seismometers that had been placed on the moon by previous Apollo crews. Orion continued orbiting for about a year before crashing into an unknown location on the moon. Now, if you find the crash site, you would find wreckage of metal and mylar scattered around. On the other hand, if the Apollo 16 service module interests you, well, it burned up on entry to the Earth's atmosphere above the Pacific Ocean. The command module, which returned the astronauts to Earth, is easy to find. CASPER, as it was called, is in the Alabama Space and Rocket Center in Huntsville. With the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 16 mission approaching, the curators at the museum decided that it was time to give CASPER a clean.
This particular command module for Apollo 16 is called CASPER. So CASPER the Friendly Ghost was a popular character at the time, and they just opted to use that as its name. We're cleaning the Apollo 16 spacecraft and the inside of the display case. So what we're doing for the inside of the display case is cleaning with microfiber cloths and distilled water. That way we're not introducing any chemicals that could interact badly with the surfaces of the spacecraft or anything. For the actual spacecraft itself, we're using a dusting technique that involves very soft brushes, a very specialized vacuum cleaner, and a technique where you sort of use the brush to lift the dust off of the surface and into the air, and then you capture the dust with the vacuum cleaner. And this prevents you from scrubbing the surface and kind of grinding the dust into the surface or anything. So as part of regular maintenance of any artifact in the museum, you want to keep sort of a regular eye on all of your objects. The time came to do that, and also it happens to be that 2022 is the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 16 mission. So it just happens to be good timing to clean it in preparation for that anniversary.
The museum curators also asked Christian Sutton to narrate this amusing first-person story of CASPER's moon adventure.
Sometimes if you're lucky, you get the chance to embark on the adventure of a lifetime. I had that chance 50 years ago when I was fortunate enough to carry 3 special astronauts to the moon and back as part of Apollo 16. My name is CASPER, and this is my story. John Young was to be our commander. He was a veteran astronaut of 3 previous space missions. There was Charlie Duke, our lunar module pilot, who was embarking on his first mission to space. And finally, there was Ken Mattingly, my pilot, and the astronaut I'd spend the most time with on our adventure. This, too, would be Ken's first space mission. Apollo 16 was one of 3 Apollo J missions, which were intended to be deeper scientific studies of the moon. The plan was for John and Charlie to travel down to the highlands on the lunar surface, between 2 mountains north of the crater Descartes. This area was believed to have been formed by extinct lunar volcanoes, making it an ideal location for research. As the mission drew near, time came for the crew to give me a name. They named the lunar excursion module, Orion, after the brightest constellation in the night sky. For me, they decided upon CASPER, after the friendly ghost from the then popular comic books and cartoon series. It had been said that the puffy white suits worn by astronauts looked shapeless and almost ghost-like when seen on television screens, which prompted the choice of my name. As launch day neared, I was integrated on top of a mighty Saturn V rocket and wheeled out to Pad 39A at Kennedy Space Center in Florida. On the morning of April 16, 1972, the crew suited up and climbed inside. Together, we were ready to blast off. The powerful F1 engines ignited at the bottom of the rocket, and we were on our way. I still remember the exhilarating sensation of leaving Earth's atmosphere and entering orbit. As I parted ways with the Saturn V, Ken proceeded to dock me with Orion, and we flew toward the moon. It took us 3 days to travel over 230,000 miles to the moon, but we finally arrived in lunar orbit on April 19th. Then on April 20th, it was time for John and Charlie to get inside Orion and separate from me and Ken. Once they were on the moon, work began. Over the course of their three EVAs on the lunar surface, John and Charlie set up numerous science experiments and used the lunar roving vehicle to explore nearby sites, collecting lunar rock samples for study back on Earth. One such rock was Big Muley, the largest sample ever returned from the moon. John and Charlie even found time to perform the ultimate test of the lunar roving vehicle, pushing it to its limits to see how fast it could actually travel with the Lunar Grand Prix. Through John and Charlie's experiments and the samples they would return to Earth, NASA was able to eventually determine that the area was not volcanic in nature as hypothesized. As John and Charlie were exploring the lunar surface, me and Ken remained up in lunar orbit, ready to carry out our mission objectives from there. Ken performed many photographic observations and science experiments using a suite of scientific instruments in my Sims Bay. Together, me and Ken were able to verify the data taken by Apollo 15's command module and provide new information on lunar terrain not previously covered. On April 23rd, John and Charlie blasted off from the lunar surface and reunited with me and Ken in orbit. We jettisoned Orion and set a course back toward Earth. While en route, Ken performed an EVA of his own, retrieving film canisters from my Sims Bay. Then by April 27th, we had made it back to Earth orbit and began atmospheric re-entry. While the heat was intense, my heat shields managed to protect the crew inside as we successfully passed through the atmosphere. When my parachutes deployed, I knew I had done my job. Together, we drifted safely toward the waters below. With my job complete, it was time to think about retirement. In November of 1973, NASA transferred me to the Smithsonian, who delivered me to the Alabama Space and Rocket Center in Huntsville, Alabama. The Alabama Space and Rocket Center, now known as the U.S. Space and Rocket Center, has remained my home for nearly 50 years. Over the years, I have had the privilege to share my unique story with guests at the center. I've even had old friends like Charlie stop by to see me from time to time. While my adventure to space may be history, I have a new and equally significant purpose, for it is the adventures I inspire in those who visit me that will carry my legacy into the future.
Poor Casper. Having been to the moon, it now spends its time locked in a glass display in Huntsville, with thousands of people gawking at it every day. Well, at least Casper's parachutes occasionally get to travel. For example, in 2019 and 2019, one of the parachutes went to Brisbane to be spread over the heads of the visitors to the Queensland Museum. And that's where I saw the parachute. More about Nothing So Hidden, the story of Apollo 16, coming up.
On FM, online, and on TuneIn, 24/7. This is 88.3 Southern FM.
I saw the crescent.
And what of the three Apollo 16 astronauts? Having flown two Gemini missions in Earth orbit and been to the moon twice, you might think that John Young's astronaut days would be over. But no, he went on to command the first and ninth space shuttle missions and was in line to command a third, this one to deploy the Hubble Space Telescope, when the STS-51L mission exploded, destroying the Challenger. I was present when he was asked, was he going to fly again? And his wife said, no. Well, he retired from NASA at the end of 2004 and died in January of 2018 at the age of 87. When Charlie Duke visited us in the Southern FM studios, I asked about what he did after Apollo 16. You returned to Earth safely and then worked, you mentioned you worked on the shuttle for a while.
Next I went to backup crew on Apollo 17, yes. Which was a surprise. They had a backup crew on 17, but they got removed for some problems. And so John Young and Stu Rooster and I became backup crew for Apollo 17 in like late June of 1972. And so we trained till the end of Apollo. As backup. And after Apollo was over, then I went to work for Space Shuttle. First in the astronaut office, monitoring crew station design, airlock, working on the crew cockpit layout, airlock, and also a little bit with Bruce McCandless on the manned maneuvering unit. Then I went on into more of a management job working as a technical assistant to the manager of the shuttle program, and then I went into shuttle operations. NASA wanted me to move to take a job in Washington as a deputy administrator for legislative affairs, but my kids didn't want to go, Dottie didn't want to go, and it was. And we'd had such a tough time with our marriage, it was going to be just a big problem moving to Washington. Mm-hmm. So I turned it down and ended up in shuttle operations when I decided to retire due to an opportunity I was presented in business.
You decided not to stay on for the shuttle flights and do that, whereas some of the other Apollo astronauts did.
Yeah, both guys I was on that it went to the moon with did. T.K. Mattingly mm-hmm. flew, I think, the third shuttle flight. John Young was the first. And then a lot of my group stayed on, and they flew shuttles. But I decided to leave. Looking back, I've had a few regrets. I sometimes wish I'd have stayed around for a couple of years with Space Shuttle and flown at least one of the test flights, and I could have done that. But I didn't, and so that was one of the regrets, I guess, partial regret, let me put it that way, that I had, that I didn't stay for another six or seven years.
And what had he done after leaving NASA? Now, it's nearly 40 years since you left NASA. Mm-hmm. What have you been doing since then?
Well, after I left NASA, I didn't have enough time in the military to finish retirement, so I went in part-time into the military Air Force Reserve. I served at Randolph Air Force Base in San Antonio until I retired in 1986. But also during that time, I was running a beverage business, and then I went into some real estate development. Then we began to develop our Christian ministry. My wife and I had this encounter with Jesus, and it was life-changing, really. And it changed our marriage and our lives so profoundly that we just wanted to go tell everybody about it. And our diocese and our parish heard the story, and well, you ought to hear this Charlie Duke. He's got a great story about the moon and then walking with the Lord. So it was sort of walk on the moon, walk with the the sun, S-O-N, and we're still doing that now. We've been all over the world sharing our faith and hopefully inspiring a lot of people. And one of the reasons we're here in Melbourne now is to speak to schools. We've been eight schools now, and we got six more to do before we depart, and spoke to two groups today, both 1,000 kids, and you know, if you can change one life and motivate one person, it's all worth it. So do that. And also I am involved now in motivational speaking. I do stuff for organizations, associations, individual companies. Work for Omega Watch, Embraer, the Brazilian airplane maker. And I do, so there I speak to management teams, and it's teamwork, delivering under pressure, importance of thorough planning, preparation. And you do good planning and preparation, the outcome usually works out. Mm-hmm. And so, because you can handle all contingencies, you can handle everything. And so I found that very motivating to me now.
Now, how do you find these school children here in Melbourne have been receiving your message?
Tremendous. Everybody is listening. Most of my audience is teenagers from like 13 to 18. Though I've spoken to one younger group, and everybody just sort of sit there and thoroughly entertained and excited. And the girls seem to be more excited than the boys. You know, they're more exuberant and more demonstrative of their emotions than guys are. But everybody gives me a good ovation, and many have come up, said it's best assembly we've ever had, and so thank you for coming. So I've been very pleased with the response.
At the time he talked with the Space Show in 2014, there was a debate raging on whether we should go back to the moon or press on to Mars. And the Obama administration was even advocating going to an asteroid. There's been an argument, of course, whether we should go back to the moon before Mars or do asteroids. What are your thoughts on that?
I think we ought to go to the moon again and build a station or moon base, whatever you want to call it, and there we develop the systems that can last for long duration. Because if we went directly to Mars without any history and experience on these systems, you're on your own. Mm-hmm. And you can't get any help from Houston at Mars. You know, it's too long of transmission. And so you're autonomous. And we need systems that we have tested, relied upon, and developed, and I think that the moon is the place to do that. And plus, we can do, there's a lot of benefits of going back to the moon science-wise. And Jack Schmidt wants to go start learning how we can mine helium-3 on the moon, which is a tremendous power source, which eventually might be useful here on Earth. So,
okay.
But I'm not much on the asteroid mission. I think that's a waste, personally.
And Charlie Duke and John Young were both appreciative of the support Australia gave to the Apollo program.
Well, I think, Charlie, we should let you go because you've had a long day and a long week. Really do appreciate you coming in and spending time with us.
Well, Andrew, Peter, I've really enjoyed being with you all. We had a nice dinner together the other night. And thank you for your support of the space program. Australia has probably one of the most active support groups of space, and we appreciate it. Thank you all for all you've done, and good to be here with you.
You've got an open invitation anytime you're back. Thank you, Charlie.
We'll do that.
Thank you for joining us on the Space Show, Charlie.
Appreciate it.
We are here to celebrate the 25th anniversary of human beings landed on the moon. I think everybody here can be very proud of the contribution that Australia has made to space exploration and the deep space tracking network. I believe that there was even more important things going on back in those days, and Mike didn't mention them. When they were trying to land on the moon, coming down, they had radar alarms, and they were overloading their computers. And the fact that that information was coming back to Houston and we were able to work that whole problem out and successfully land those people is in large part due to Honeysuckle and Parks having that information available and being able to use it in real time and solve those problems. So I think everybody in Australia can be very proud of that contribution, because on the first landing going to the moon, if you have to abort, it really looked bad on your record.
And Duke now lives in Charlotte, North Carolina, aged 86. Apollo 16 command module Ken Mattingly made 64 orbits of the moon, becoming one of only 24 people to have flown to the moon. He went on to fly two space shuttle missions, one in 1982 and the other in 1985. After leaving NASA in 1985, Mattingly worked for several aerospace companies. Now, Wikipedia says that, at age 86, he is working in Virginia at a company called Systems Planning and Analysis. The American Space Museum and Spacewalk of Fame in Titusville gives the same information, although this may just be a copy of the wiki entry. Now, you may be wondering why we have called this program about Apollo 16 Nothing So Hidden. Well, the first clue is that Apollo 16 landed in the highland region of the moon near the crater Descartes. This 48-kilometer diameter crater was named after René Descartes, a French philosopher and mathematician. This extract from the official public release movie of the Apollo 16 movie.
As Young and Duke rode the Bucking Rover to the lunar formation called Stone Mountain, NASA geologist Farouk Elbaz wrote on a blackboard on Earth, "There is nothing so far removed from us to be beyond our reach, or so hidden that we cannot discover it." René Descartes. As John Young would later remark, Apollo 16 would certainly help prove that René Descartes was right.
Compact, almost like a freshly plowed field that's been rained on.
During that homeward bound press conference, John Young had this to say.
Well, let me just say one thing, Hank, and that is, Mr. Descartes said it. He said, there's nothing so far removed from us as to be beyond our reach, or so hidden that we cannot discover it. And, you know, Descartes was a French mathematician and philosopher for whom the region was named. And I guess, really the story of our mission so far is we've been out testing this theory. My personal assessment of where we are right now, as soon as we get the rocks back in the LRL, we'll be making headway toward proving he was right.
And this caused NASA to title its public release documentary Nothing So Hidden. And we here on The Space Show have followed suit. If you want to know more about Apollo 16 or of the other Apollo missions, then a good starting point is Eric Jones's Apollo Lunar Surface Journal. This deals with what was said and done on the moon. Space Association President Peter Arwood had this conversation with Eric.
I'm sitting here with Eric Jones. Eric, welcome to The Space Show.
Thank you very much, Peter.
Eric, you are the editor of the Apollo Lunar Surface Journal. Could you tell us a little bit about that and how it came into being?
Yeah, I've been working on it for over a quarter century. Back in 89, I had a chance to talk to Jack Schmidt, who flew on 17, who was an occasional visitor to the Los Alamos Scientific Laboratory, where I worked for 30 years. And I was interested in how work got done on the moon. I'd come to Australia for the first time 3 years earlier in 86 on professional leave at Melbourne University. I was interested in how the Australian economy emerged from the prison colony, and had read Geoffrey Blainey's The Tyranny of Distance, and understood that the cost of getting things here from Europe or even from India had a lot to do with how the Australian economy got cranked up. And a future settlement on the moon is going to have larger difficulties of the same kind. One of the things that I did when I was here was start digging into the journals of Captain Cook, which were the modern edition of them, was put together by a New Zealand historian named J.C. Beaglehole, who basically spent his life work on exploration of the Pacific and Cook's career. He edited the journals in preparation for writing a life of Cook. And the journals are just an absolutely marvelous resource about that wonderful period of exploration. And Cook was very much a man of the age. Like most of the astronauts, he was military. He'd grown up in the coal trade. But he was interested in the scientific work that was being done by Banks and others. So anyway, I started getting a notion, maybe even before I talked to Jack, about using the transcripts from the Apollo missions as the basis of a journal, emphasizing, because of my own interests, and because of interest in how a lunar settlement might support itself, in the work that was done by the crews, how they trained for it, things of that kind. So Jack and I talked about it for an hour or so that first time, and got together a few months later at his Albuquerque office, and went through a bit of the journal, through a bit of the transcripts, stopping frequently so I could ask him what the hell's going on and how did you train for that, what was easy about it, what was hard about it. We decided that it was worth doing, not only for the whole of Apollo 17, but he offered to write a letter of recommendation to the other crew so we could go through all six of the missions, or at least the lunar surface operations.
So these transcripts, the audio was already transcribed, I presume, by NASA and existed in the NASA archives, and your idea was to publish them on a website to make them publicly accessible, or more easily publicly accessible. Is that the concept?
The audio from the missions was transcribed basically in real time. The NASA Public Affairs had a crew of typists behind a curtain in the main auditorium, and they would be given tapes from the audio so they could type it up pretty much in real time for the media, because the media, of course, wanted, particularly on 11, wanted to have instant access to transcripts. And then later on, the transcripts were of great use to the geologists trying to working with the samples that the crews collected.
Okay, so that's the origin of the Apollo Lunar Surface Journal. So how did you envision structuring it? What was your concept of putting it together? How it would be used, how it would continue to grow as it has for so many years since that time?
What the journal was, what was in it, evolved over the 30 years and is still evolving. But the first and most important task was to contact the other astronauts and arrange to meet with them, usually at their office or occasionally at their home. When I started out, I simply had copies of the transcripts, a copy for each of us, copies of the audio so we could listen to it and correct the transcript as we went along, that was it, basically. I started acquiring background documents, and the guys had souvenirs in the form of manuals and photographs and what have you, which was very helpful. I was remarkably ignorant about Apollo in 1989. I watched the missions on the tube, but in terms of the detail and what was involved in the training and in what they did on the moon, I was clueless. And they were very generous in confronting my ignorance and helping me understand what was going on. So in the early 90s, I continued to work with Jack Schmidt, and he and I spent probably 15 to 20 days together over a few years. He got Cernan involved, probably spent a dozen days with Gene over the years, going through the mission. And eventually I acquired a set of the videotapes. A fellow named Larry Haskin at Washington University in St. Louis had compiled those, and that was a big help. Couldn't have done the journal as it now exists without those videotapes. So we would sit down and go through it. Jack and Gene in the beginning. Then I had 3 days with Neil and Buzz in Santa Fe at a hotel, and 5 days with Pete now, which was a hoot. A laugh a minute. Pete is a very funny guy. Spent 2 weeks at Ed Mitchell's home in Florida, two separate weeks. A little time with Jim Irwin at his office in Colorado Springs, but I regret that Jim really was quite busy in his ministry and his public speaking tour, so we didn't get together very often. Dave Scott was a huge help. He and I would get together in Santa Fe for a couple of days every once in a while. And later with Charlie Duke at his home, pretty much had it covered. John Young declined to participate, as did Shepard. But other than that, I had the full attention of nine of them.
So what did that work involve? Did it involve going through and maybe correcting some of what was written as opposed to what was actually said? But were you sort of asking them questions, clarifying what they were doing at this point, and then writing notes and adding that to the journal itself?
Absolutely. I, of course, tape recorded those conversations that I had with the astronauts. We would stop frequently, either because they wanted to explain something or I had a question for them about what they were doing, how they trained for it. And those conversations were transcribed after the sessions were finished, and those have been added to the journal online.
Okay, so you said you recorded those conversations. There's the NASA Oral History Series. Is that your recordings, or is that something totally different?
No, the NASA Oral History Program, the NASA Johnson Oral History Program, is a separate process. Those are shorter conversations with not only the astronauts, but lots of other people who worked at NASA. Those are very helpful. But my conversations with the astronauts were focused strictly on lunar surface operations, what they were doing in real time, and how they trained for it.
And do those recordings still exist? And is there any plans, or do you have permission to, at some stage, publish them or put them up online somewhere? I think a lot of people are interested.
I know people are interested in them. I'm reluctant to release those yet. Most of the time, when the guys had something they wanted to tell me that wasn't for public consumption, they would ask that I turn the tape recorder off, which I was happy to do. One of the people who has helped me with the journal is my good friend Ken Glover in Ottawa, Canada, who digitized all those tapes for me. So they are in a safe location, and I haven't decided when I'm going to release those.
I guess the sad reality of life of the time since Apollo is that, one by one, these people that walked on the moon are leaving us. So I guess in some cases, in many ways, those recordings are a real piece of history in their own right, in addition to the Lunar Surface Journal itself. And it's wonderful they still exist and you've preserved them, and hopefully one day they'll come out when the time is right.
And when the time is right is the operative part. The guys grew to understand, after we had spent some time together, that I was serious about understanding the missions, respectful of their privacy, and willing to talk about things off the record, that some of which get discussed in their conversations with Andy Chaikin for Man on the Moon, and others show up in their books. But it wasn't my job to do more than talk about what they did, how they did it.
That was The Space Show's Peter Owood talking with Eric Jones, the editor of the Apollo Lunar Surface Journal. And yes, Eric is now a proud Australian living here in Victoria. Now, if you want to know more about Apollo 16 or of the other Apollo missions, then a good starting point is, as we've just noted, Eric Jones's Apollo Lunar Surface Journal. But if you want to know details about what was said or done on the way to the moon, in orbit around the moon, or on the way back to Earth, then head to the Apollo Flight Journal. In addition, Colin McKellar's Honeysuckle Creek site has an incredible wealth of material on Australia's involvement in tracking the Apollo missions. That's where we got the audio of John Saxon talking with the crew of Apollo 16, and where you can hear the full unedited audio and read a transcript. And we're going to hear from John Saxon after these messages.
88.3 Southern FM, the sounds of the Bayside.
If you believe they put a man on the moon, man on the moon. If you believe.
On last week's program, we told you the story of how John Saxon became the only Australian to talk to someone on the moon. At a recent Space Association of Australia meeting, President Peter Owood introduced John to the members.
Next, we're going to hear from John Saxon. John was the operations supervisor at Honeysuckle Creek at the tracking station here. He supported all the Apollo missions at the operations console. And John also spoke to John Young and Charlie Duke on the lunar surface. If he gets time, he might tell you about that. He wasn't supposed to, but he stepped in and had to fill in the gap. We'll hand over to John Saxon now.
What I'm preparing to do is to give you a flavour of the Honeysuckle Station. Yeah, well, this is telling everybody what they already knew, and that is that you need three stations around the Earth to give you some coverage of the moon as soon as they're beyond geosynchronous orbit, actually a little bit below that. And equally so, these were the three stations, and here was Honeysuckle down there, Goldstone in the Mojave Desert, and Madrid, just up in the hills above Madrid, really. And it was opened by yet another Prime Minister, Harold Holt. Yes, Harold Holt visited the station after he had opened it officially with, that was in 17th of March 1967. The station itself was built mostly in 1966. I arrived there after spending some time in the Network Training Center in Greenbelt, Maryland, which I went to before I actually emigrated out to Australia. So I had to fly from England to Greenbelt to go for the training, which was called the Manned Space Flight Operations Supervisor Training or something similar. And then I had to fly back to England in order to emigrate down to Australia.
Picturesque natural surroundings and bearing an equally picturesque name, the Honeysuckle Creek Tracking Station. Dominated by its saucer-shaped radio antenna 85 feet in diameter, it's the sixth such station to be constructed in Australia and places this country second only to America as the Western world's most important space-tracking country. Prime Minister Holt performs the official opening ceremony. Built by the United States National Aeronautics and Space Administration at a cost of $2 million, Honeysuckle Creek is operated by Australian firms employing homegrown scientists, engineers, and technicians. Honeysuckle Creek is virtually an earthbound ear to a man on the moon, being one of three stations destined to guide the Apollo project to a manned landing on our nearest space neighbor, scheduled for 1970. Together with the deep space tracking station at Tidbin Villa, 14 miles to the west, it'll play a vital role in the critical final stages of the moon landing. Mr. Holt sets the antenna in motion at the press of a button. Honeysuckle Creek, another step in man's most exciting journey, a quarter of a million miles into space.
This was sort of ground plan, of rough site plan, antenna up on the hill, the operations building, and down below was the power generation building, had all the diesel generators, and also many little offices or workshops for electricians, air conditioning people, motor mechanics, huge number of people with skills in those sort of areas. The operations building, which was sort of 1.5 stories high, ground level, then up some stairs into the operations room up above. I should just mention that this was the, it says crew room, but actually it was a cafeteria, and right next, which was a 24/7 operation, and right next door to it was a couple of bedrooms, which were almost impossible to sleep in because of all the noise that came out of the cafeteria 24/7. Anyhow, occasionally you got a few hours. I did sleep on site quite a few times, or try to. And up here, we've got the main operations area. First of all, the unified S-band area, which is the same as the area at Tidman Villa, which is the controls for the transmitters, receivers, pointing in the antenna, and tracking data originating and all the rest of it. Next door to it was the telemetry operation aerial. We had three decommutators for the spacecraft telemetry data. And we could, the great thing about it was in manned spaceflight, you could actually see all the activity that was going on, see all the temperatures, pressures, and many things like the astronaut respiration and heartbeat and stuff like that, which was probably the most important part. Computer area, quite a lot of stuff in the computer area. I'll show you in a minute. We had a hatch going through to the communications area so they could pass through teletype messages and this type of thing. And that was called the communications switch room, but it was really the wire room mostly, where all the intercoms, every position had different sets of buttons on it, and they were all wired up in there. And really, what the operator is doing, he can drive the antenna to the acquisition point where we expect the spacecraft to appear. And then once it does appear, it's a sort of a dance between him and the receiver operators. When the receivers are locked up on the spacecraft, then he can select automatic track, and the antenna will then follow the spacecraft. Pretty cunning system, actually, because they had four feed horns pointing down the bore side of the antenna, and the whole idea of the servo system was to balance the output of those four feed horns so the antenna was always focused directly on the spacecraft. Controls for the power amplifiers, transmitters, and there was some chart recorders which were very handy at times to find out what actually happened. This was the ranging equipment. The ranging was interesting subsystem in that this guy was the only guy who really understood it. It was used a system of transmitting a pseudo-random number code. That was a random number code which repeated. So it was called a pseudo-random numbers. And when they were reflected back from the spacecraft, they were compared, and you could measure the spacecraft distance to an accuracy of, 2 or 3 meters at lunar distance. took that over a period of time. You got the velocity of the spacecraft and so on, accelerations in all axes in the end. This was 1.5 decommutators in the telemetry area. It's a sort of simulation rack there, but that's one of the decommutators going down here. This is another one. Get all this stuff in one chip in your phone these days, I'm sure. Also, there was 3 of these in the telemetry area, plus TV equipment for when we got TV from the moon, plus recorders, analog tape recorders. This was the computer area. So there was a lot of gear there, and this was one of the main computers. We had 2 of those, one for telemetry and one for command data. Item in the middle was called the expanded memory unit. We also had paper tape drives, you name it, data tapes for driving the antenna along the expected track of the spacecraft, and another one for simulations and other purposes. One of these computers, I can tell you, was, I think, had a 2 microsecond cycle time, had something like 16K, or it might have been 32K of 30-bit memory, and lots of input-output channels. Did a lot of parallel computing going on in there, including handling the tape handlers and many other functions. This was the operations console. Now, I should say something about this because basically it was where Mike and I worked. I was lucky enough to do all the Apollo missions there, plus Skylab, plus various other bits and pieces from that console. I should say that around the manned spaceflight network, it was expected that all the equipment would be the same in all the stations, so that when they sent out instructions and all the rest of it, they would know how the stations were laid out and what the controls were and all the rest of it. This console, after Mike Dinn finished with it, bore absolutely no resemblance to any other console in the manned spaceflight network.
Speaking to the Space Association of Australia, that was John Saxon, who had various jobs at the Honeysuckle Creek tracking site that's in the Australian Capital Territory. Well, this has been the final episode of our 3-part series, Nothing So Hidden, the story of Apollo 16.